My name is Jocelyn. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here this evening and very grateful to be sober. I want to thank Mark for asking us, and I want to welcome the newcomer. And congratulations to those that are here that did not identify, and happy birthday in advance to those that are on your board. Let's see, the formalities. My sobriety date is September 13, 2016. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I have the privilege and the honor of walking other women through the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I also have a lot of service commitments. I'm very involved in hospitals and institutions in Bakersfield and Kern County. And how I identify as an alcoholic is because when I take that first drink, the phenomenon of craving sets in, and I cannot stop. And I wake up in strange places with strange people doing strange things, and I cannot for the life of me figure out how in the heck I got here. How did this happen, right? And I swear it off, like, oh my God, this is never going to happen again. And then what happens is the obsession of the mind, right? And then that alcoholic amnesia sets in. It won't be so bad the next time. Just go over here, or just do this, or just hang out with them, right? And so I'm doing it over and over and over again, expecting a different result. And where my alcoholism takes me is, you know, all those low bottoms that we hear about, right? What I know today is that it was definitely for me a spiritual bankruptcy that brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because as you're going to hear, that I can keep digging. I can have a bottom, and then, you know, people would be like, oh my God, how could she ever drink again? And then I can drink again and make that bottom. I pull out that shovel and I keep digging. So what it was like, very similar to Evan, I was afforded every opportunity as a child. I was adopted by two very well-meaning parents who afforded me every opportunity, and it was never enough. I had a gaping hole of fear, a gaping hole of not enoughness. I wondered why you had what you had and I didn't have it. I wondered why your families interacted the way they interacted and my family didn't. Why doesn't my mom love me like that? And I never lied because I was a liar. I embellished the truth because I wanted you to like me. I wanted you to accept me. I wanted to be more than I was. It was just never enough. And when I took that first drink of alcohol at the age of 12, I found the solution. I found the solution to that gaping hole of fear and not enoughness. It filled it up temporarily, and I thought, my God, I'm going to do whatever I can to get more of this, because this is the elixir of life, right? And what that looked like for me at age 12 was, I was in Spain when I took my first drink. And that's what I mean by I had no reason to have to embellish the truth. I had a pretty good little life, right? And so my behavior became increasingly out of control, and my parents made the decision to move back to the United States, and I ended up in Ridgecrest, California. And I like to share that, especially in meetings that are going to know what I'm talking about, right? And I had felt like I arrived, because anything and everything was afforded, you know, available. And but my life spiraled out of control at a very young age, and I started participating in criminal behavior and criminal activity, getting suspended, getting expelled, going to juvenile hall, going to longer facilities that had longer stints of time, and it just progressively got worse, and it got to the point where my poor parents did not know what to do, and I became a ward of the court. And what I can tell you is, all that did was fuel a very deep-seated resentment. How dare you? Why did you even bother to adopt me if this is what you were going to do? And don't you know what I've been through? You know, and I just never taking any accountability for my actions. And so ended up in and out of group homes, you know, just the typical, you know, the trauma, the woes me, the, you know, all this stuff, right? So at the age of 17, I ended up getting pregnant. Well, before that, I was in an emancipation group home, and my parents were like, well, you're doing really well. We're going to let you come home. And so I came home, and I was doing really well for a few months, right? And then I was off and running again. But what changed for me is I got pregnant with my first son, and I desperately wanted to be a good parent, right? I did. I wanted to love my son the way I felt like I was never loved, and, you know, just so selfish and self-centered. So I have my son, and what that looks like is, three kids, three different baby daddies, in and out of these really crazy relationships. And what I always like to share about that experience is I'm not a victim. I chose where I was at in relationships. And if you weren't as sick as me, I was going to make you sick as me. I was going to push you until you hit me. I dare you, because I needed you to be right there so I could feel just a little bit better about myself, right? And I dragged my kids through this. But as a lot of us alcoholics, I'm a great chameleon. I can make things appear as though they're going really well. And I scrounge up enough junior college to get out of Ridgecrest, because Ridgecrest is my problem, right? So what's happening in a small desert town is, on these weekends, at this point I'm an intermittent drinker, right? I'm having these negative consequences. These crazy things are happening, and swear it off. And then, you know, a week or two later, I'm doing the exact same thing. And participating in all kinds of extra party favors, and life is, you know, just spiraling out of control again. And but I went to the community college in Ridgecrest and got like 60 units, C minus average, but it was my way out. I just had to get out of Ridgecrest, right? So I moved to Ridgecrest with my three kids. We pack up and brand new life, and I get this great job with the county. And for the first couple of years, I did really well. I worked very alcoholically and stepped on some toes and climbed up and, you know, got promoted to supervisor. And I started going to happy hour with some coworkers. And at some point, I crossed that invisible line that we talk about, right? And alcohol ceased to be a luxury and started to become more and more of a necessity. And I'm watching my coworkers, and I'm watching their drinks, and I'm trying to maintain the amount I'm drinking because I don't want to seem like I'm drinking way too much. But then they leave. They're ready to go home after a drink or two. And I'm like, where's the after party? And I'm going down to the clubs. And here I am, a supervisor for the county, and I'm partying downtown at the clubs, you know, any night of the week. A party is a party, right? And then what's happening is I'm leaving my kids home alone before they're old enough to be left home alone. I'm not buying groceries. That's not a priority. I need my money to party, right? And then I'm trying to maintain this job. And at this point, I have a house and a car payment, you know, all the stuff, right? And life is starting to get, you know, really lifey. And I'm having a really hard time dealing with it. And so I take a leave of absence from my job, right? I have stress. I work for the county, the welfare department. I'm under extreme stress. So, you know, I ride that out for a long time. And then I go back to work. And I'm calling out some days. Some days I'm not even calling out, because I... Don't you know who I am? I'm a union employee, and they can't fire me. And a coworker told me, you know what? They're going to fire you. And I'm like, they can't fire me. I'm a union employee. She said, no, they're going to fire you. You might think about resigning. So that's what I did. And what that looked like for me was a great excuse to drink all day long. And I resigned from that job. It was a huge, huge blow to my pride and my ego. And yeah, I just started having to drink in the mornings. It got to be that serious, where I was starting to wake up with, you know, shaking and all the stuff that we go through. And I alcohol had become my master. It was the single most important thing in my life. And my parents were still living in Ridgecrest, and they wanted to go to Florida to retire. And so they asked me to bring the kids to Ridgecrest, and we were going to have a family get together on Labor Day of 2004. And I desperately wanted to go and make it appear as though everything was okay, right? Everybody sees, you know, I just lost this job I'd been at for 10 years, and everything's falling to pieces. I'm not even able to pay my mortgage. And but I desperately wanted to make it appear as though things were good. So I thought, I'm going to practice some controlled drinking and just make it to Ridgecrest. And my 12-year-old daughter at the time asked if her best friend could come, and her best friend's little brother. And so I said, yeah, because I had a large enough SUV. We all piled in the car. I only drank what I needed to be well enough to get to Ridgecrest. And when I got there, you know, my sister could see I was shaking. She's like, do you want to have a drink? And I'm like, yes, please. And of course, I did what any good alcoholic does. And I overshoot the mark. And I come to the next morning, and here I am in Ridgecrest in my parents' house. And I'm sick. And I know there's no way I'm going to make it through the day if I don't get a drink in me. And so I knew that I had to drive. It was Labor Day of 2004. I knew that I had to drive home with those five kids that day. And I continued to drink. And So later in the afternoon, it was time to go, and I piled the kids in the car. I drank some coffee. My alcoholic thinking, my best thinking told me it was okay to get behind the wheel of the car with those five kids. And about 30 minutes into my drive, I lost control of my vehicle. We rolled a couple of times, and my 12-year-old daughter passed away in that accident on impact. And I would love to tell you that that was my bottom, which I talked about in the beginning of my share. And what I can tell you is, in the pits of my despair, I could not see past myself. It was all about me. Don't you know what I've been through? Don't you know I've lost my only daughter? You know, my family had to take over. I completely lost grip with reality, and it was all about me. And if I'm being very honest, the single most important thing to me was I knew I had a prior DUI, and I knew I was going to prison. And that consumed me. And I had, you know, superficially, of course, I had regard for the other children and my two sons, but really, to the core of my selfishness and self-centeredness, I could not see past myself. And I ended up going to the courts in Ridgecrest. They granted me a lot of leniency. They closed the courtroom, and I was sentenced to 6 years in state prison. And I want to tell you why it's such a privilege and an honor to be up here. I'm currently working with somebody who's sitting in the California Women's Institution, and she's actually from this area, and she was sentenced to life for the same crime that I was convicted of. And so for me to be here, standing here with you and sharing my experience, strength, and hope, what a gift, right? And it's more than that, it's my debt to Alcoholics Anonymous, because as you'll hear, of course, we all know, right? Life gets better when we do the work. So, but it took a long time for that to happen for me after that accident. So I went to prison full of I'm gonna. Hospitals and institutions would come in. I'd listen to what you all had to say, but I was going to do it my way, right? Because I, of course, know what's best for Jocelyn. And so I get out of prison. I go to meetings just like this. I'm the last one to get there. I'm the first one to leave. I don't want any one of you coming up to me, because none of you could possibly relate to me. You have no idea what I've been through, right? I don't get a sponsor. I don't ask for phone numbers. And it's a matter of months before I'm off and running again with ex-husband number three, off into Corona Sunset, right? And that was like the craziest year of my life. Cumulatively, like the most insane year of my life. And you know, it talks about where we pick up right where we left off, and that's what it was like for me. And what that looked like for me was high control parole. They knew I was drinking. I'd get parole violation after parole violation. I'd go back to prison for, this was back when they sent you back to prison for violations, and I just could not. I could get sober, right? I'd go to these parole places and get sober, but I could not stay sober. And I didn't want anything to do with your God, right? I was so resentful at God, so angry, so resentful at, you know, just everybody, the whole list, right? And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Hold on. So, I what that looked like for me was 9.5 years of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I ended up getting off of parole, and it was not because of good behavior, right? They took me off 3.5 years because they had to. Like, they really probably didn't even want to take me off parole. But I got off parole, and what that looked like for me, I was unemployable. I couldn't work. I manipulated my parents into paying off the mortgage because I had severe PTSD and every other diagnosis that you could possibly come up with. And I'm renting out rooms to people off of Craigslist, and as soon as you make me mad, I'm stealing your stuff and changing the locks. And that was my life for years. And what happened during that time, right at 9.5 years after getting out of prison for that crime, what happened was, one of the things I told myself I'd never do, I'll never drink and drive again, right? And it was 10 minutes till 12. It was cold, and Shell closed at midnight. So I had 10 minutes, and I knew I didn't have enough alcohol. And by this point, my alcoholism has progressed to where I'm going to the emergency room because I'm withdrawing so bad. Like, I'm totally overutilizing the medical system, going in and out of the ERs. And I knew that I didn't have enough alcohol, and I had a car, you know, no insurance, no license, practically only ran when it wanted to. But I thought, my alcoholic thinking told me, you can make it, Jocelyn. Shell's right around the corner. And so I did. I made it to Shell, and it was right around the corner, and I was so happy. I went in there, got my 240s, right, because that's all I can afford, and I'm bumming change from my adult kids at this point. And I get in the car, and I thought, well, that went so well. I'm going to go over to Jack in the Box and get two tacos, right, because that's my budget. And I pull out of Jack in the Box, and I don't have my lights on, and I pull out in front of a car, and the car's coming 45 miles an hour. And the only reason that car didn't hit me is because I got stuck on an embankment. And long story short, I got arrested for a DUI, and they cited and released me. And I thought, oh, thank you, God. Thank you. I swear this is my sign. I'm going to get sober, right? And I have to go to court in 30 days. And I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna stay sober. Well, I don't stay sober not one day. As a matter of fact, I take a bunch of party favors to just get into court, right? And I can't wait for it to be over so that I can have a drink. And I go into the municipal court, and they're like, you've been moved over to the Superior Court. So I go over to the Superior Court. And I'm the first case they call. I'm remanded into custody, $100,000 bail. The head of the DUI task force is there, and they let me know that they're going to be prosecuting me to the full extent of the law. And I thought, they're just trying to scare me. They're just trying to scare me. This poor woman, right? And they were not kidding. They would not offer me a plea bargain, and I sat in county jail, and I sat in county jail, and they would not offer me a plea bargain. And I finally thought, well, I'll just go to trial. I have nothing to lose, and, you know, I'm a pro by this time. I know this time counts, right? So I'm just riding it out, and I go to trial, and it's this long, drawn-out process, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving is up front and center, and, you know, right in the front row, and they get to stand up and introduce themselves, and I'm like, they're getting more attention than me, and it's my trial. And it took the jury less than 10 minutes to find me guilty, and what I can tell you is that if there was a noose in that holding tank, I would have walked into it. I wanted to die. I could not believe I was going back to prison. The maximum sentence, it was 3 years for a prior DUI with a felony. They could double that because of I had a strike, a prior strike, and then they could add a year enhancement. So they got the maximum sentence was 7 years in state prison. And I could not believe that I was going back to prison again. I could not believe that it was happening to me. I'm like, how could this possibly be happening to me? I'm a good person, you know? I couldn't even fathom. And I believe that's when I had my first spiritual experience. God entered that holding tank with me and told me, you just need to surrender. And I used to think, what are you guys talking about, surrender? I've already lost everything. What could I possibly surrender, right? So what I learned is God has a very funny sense of humor. I ended up in the exact same low-level fire camp in Malibu, and the same exact people from hospitals and institutions, some of them, you know, some were new, but some of them were the exact same people 9.5 years later, and it blew me away. That was my first God shot, like where I started to just look at things differently, like, wow, they've been doing this all these years. And I just started listening to what they were saying and started taking suggestions. And that's what I know today was my surrender, is when I set aside those opinions, those attitudes, those judgments, and just start listening to what you have to say and taking those suggestions and just trying it out. So they tell me to reach out to GSO in New York and ask for somebody to write, right? And I do that. And when you do that, you don't tell them why you're in prison. You just tell them your release date, female, age, right? Then they hook you up with somebody clear across the United States because they do not want you harassing them when you get out of prison. So, and what that person does is she writes GSO, our World Services Office of Alcoholics Anonymous, says, I'd like to write somebody in prison, my age, how many years sober I have. That's it. She doesn't say anything about her past. So I get a letter from Wendy Z from Berkeley, Michigan, and she had been to prison for vehicular manslaughter, and she knew exactly what I was going through. And she told me, you're going to have to share your story, or you're not going to be able to stay sober. And I said, well, there's no way that I can. I can't even talk about it without breaking down. Well, she said, you're going to have to if you want to stay sober. And this woman wrote me faithfully the entire time I was incarcerated. And I just want to add this because this is something new. So I was supposed to meet her at our convention in Detroit, and that got canceled due to COVID, and I was devastated, right? I already had my plane ticket, hotel room, and so I thought, gosh, one day I really want to meet her. And she just reached out to me randomly a few months ago and said, me and my husband are taking a cruise, and we're going to be taking off out of Long Beach. And I said, well, come stay with us, right? Only in AA does that happen, where you're inviting strangers. Just come on, come stay with me and my husband. So Wendy comes to California, and I got to meet her. I got to meet this woman that wrote me all those years ago, and what an incredible experience that was. And we're really not supposed to do that. It's like, not, you know, but she remained my friend all this time, and it was such a gift to be able to finally meet that woman that did that for me, because it helped me walk through, you know, some of the hardest years of my life. And so I'm in prison, right? Hospitals and institutions is coming in. I'm listening to the suggestions, so I reach out to a family friend who's in the program, and I ask her to be my sponsor, and all kinds of God shops happened. All kinds of laws changed, over-sentencing of non-serious, non-violent offenders. Time gets chopped off. I end up in a reentry program in Bakersfield, right? I got my little sponsor. Life is good. And if I do really good in this program, I get to go out and get a job after 6 months of programming, right? So I'm super excited, and I'm getting on the public bus, right, and with my ankle monitor, and so excited, because I just know I'm going to get a job, right? I did not get a job. Nine interviews, and nobody would hire me. And I always share this, because to this day, when I go into Chipotle, I'm baffled. I interviewed at Chipotle 3 times, and I'm not talking the same Chipotle, 3 different Chipotles, and nobody would hire me. And I couldn't figure out why, and I was so discouraged. And there was a woman that worked at the program I was at, and she was a member of the other fellowship, and she said, Jocelyn, go up to Subway and ask for Annette. And I thought, Subway? I am 46 years old, Subway? And I said, you know, Chipotle was as low as I was willing to go. So, but what I learned is to take suggestions, right? So I walk up to Subway, and they hire me. And what I can tell you is God put me exactly where I was supposed to be. The owner took me under her wing. She promoted me to assistant manager. She told me, I know that you're not going to be with us long, but as long as you're here, we're going to work with you. If you need time off for your DUI classes, for your parole classes, whatever you need, we're here for you. And she became like my angel. And all of those coworkers, I'm still very close with today, 8 years later. And it was just an incredible experience of just taking the suggestion so I can land right where God would have me be. Not where Jocelyn would have me be, at Chipotle. Where God would have me be. And it was the perfect job, right? So I move out to sober living, and I'm doing the deal, and I'm at the bus stop, and you guys are from Lancaster, you know what I'm talking about. It's 110 degrees, and I'm at the bus stop, and people are throwing crap out the windows. And I'm crying to my sponsor, I don't know if I can do this. And she's like, Jocelyn, 1 foot in front of the other, you're going to be amazed a year from now. And I'm like, well, I don't have any other alternative, so I'm going to believe you, right? So I end up saving up enough money. I get my little studio apartment. The state of California gives me my license back, and that's that. In itself, it was revoked twice, and I get my little hoopty car that only works when it wants to. The air doesn't work only sometimes. I have that breathing apparatus in the car. I'm working at Subway. I'm going to school at night, and I'm staying really busy. And a year into my sobriety, you know, I'm staying busy. I have my little commitment. I'm a secretary at a meeting. But a year into my sobriety, I'm standing in my apartment. And it's quiet, and I have nothing to do. And that gaping hole of fear and not enoughness came back. And I knew that if I didn't do something different, I was going to drink, and it scared me to death. And I really loved the woman that took me under her wing as being my sponsor for my first year of sobriety. I consider her my Eskimo, and we're still very close friends to this day. But I knew that I needed to do something different. And there was this woman that would come into the meeting that I secretary, and I really admired her. I was very intimidated by her. She had been to prison but didn't act like it. She had an amazing job with an amazing company, and I was like, how did she do that? She got a pardon by the governor, you know. She's super involved in H&I, which is something I really wanted to do. And I was so intimidated by her, I reached out to her on Facebook Messenger and asked her if she'd be willing to take me through the 12 steps. And so she gives me a time to call her, and what I know to this day, 8 years later, when she says 7 o'clock, she does not mean 7:05. She means 7 o'clock, respect her time, and set a timer, right? So I call her, and I tell her my sad sob story. I just go on, and she allows me to. It was the one time she allowed me to. And I just go on and on and on about the wrongs that have happened to me in my life, and oh, the trauma. And she listens, and at the end she said, I'd be willing to walk you through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, but what I need you to know is that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of your troubles. And if your family ever wanted anything to do with you again, that's not promised in the big book. Show me where it says it. That's not a promise. But she said, and you'd be lucky if they ever did want to after what you put them through. But what I can tell you is if you're willing to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you will experience a freedom, and you will have a spiritual experience that will transform your life. And I thought, well, God, you know, okay, right? So we set forth, we start working the steps, and this woman, I swear, I thought she didn't like me. I would leave her house and get in my car and cry and be like, you know, I'm just going to fire her when we're done with these steps. I know what she knows what she's talking about, but she's just jealous. She's just jealous of me. I would come up with all kinds of crazy things in my head. But I kept showing up every week, and we worked the 12 steps. And what I can tell you is, they say you will be amazed before you are halfway through. For me, that did happen. After step 5, my life transformed, and I started to see things differently. It was almost as though everything was black and white and turned color, right? And it, everything, I just started feeling differently and started feeling love in a whole new way, right? And it was just incredible. And it was amazing, and I have to tell you, so I went to school to be a drug and alcohol counselor, because isn't that what we all do when we get out of prison? We become drug and alcohol counselors, right? But God slammed that door shut in my face. I got a job, I got offered a job, and there was a problem with my, I don't know, the timeline for the licensing. That didn't work out. And the place wanted me. They said, well, we'll just hire you as a job developer. I said, cool. And then CDCR, prison, you know, the parole department, they're like, no, you haven't been out long enough. You can't work there. And I remember sitting in my car crying and going, my God, what am I going to do? I can't work at Subway for the rest of my life, right? So I go through this program through the Mexican American Opportunity Foundation, and I get trained in a new skill. They help convicted felons rebuild their lives, right? So I go through this program, and I get trained in the medical field. I get a job at a doctor's office. I do really well. I said, well, I'm going to start applying for jobs that have benefits because, you know, I'm getting older. I need insurance, and I'd love weekends off. So I apply for this company called GemCare, and I'm waiting for the background check, and if any of you have felony convictions, you know it takes a freaking month, right? So I'm waiting, and I'm full of fear, and my sponsor, if you're supposed to be there, if God wants you to be there, you'll be there, and if you're not there, it's because God doesn't want you to be there, and he has something better at plan. And I used to just say, whatever, you know, whatever. And but, you know, I would try to practice what I've learned. And some days, you know, I'd give it to God and then take it back and be full of fear. So they call me in and they say, the gal from HR says, she puts her hand on the paperwork. She goes, nobody needs to know about this. Welcome to GemCare. So I get the job. And this is no lie. 30 days later, we get bought out by Dignity Health. And they say, welcome to Dignity Health, everybody. We're going to run new background checks on everybody. And we have a 7-year zero tolerance policy, and we have to fill out all this paperwork. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I couldn't believe that this was happening. But I, you know, what I had learned through working the steps and going through that first experience is there were days where I really knew if God wants me to be here, I'm going to be here. And if he doesn't, there's something better in store. I'm not going to sit here and say there were days that I wasn't riddled in fear, because there was. But what I can tell you is 8 years later, I still have the same employer. And I've gotten different jobs that have had to run different background checks, right? Like I had access to your financial information, so they had to run a consumer credit report, all this stuff, right? And I'm still there. So it's evident to me that this is where God would have me be. And what I can tell you is I look at the job that I have today is my living amends, because of all the years I'd go in and out of the hospitals. And this was before Obamacare and, you know, Medi-Cal and all of that, and just take complete advantage. And I get to be I get to be of service to the patients that I work for an enhanced care management program where I deal with people just like me, right? And I get to meet them where they're at, and I get to give back a little bit every day. So that's one of the gifts of the program. The other gift is that my dad, who hadn't talked to me in a really long time, decides he wants to move to Bakersfield so I can help him with my mom, who has Alzheimer's. And he tells me, you know, I want you to go find a house. He gives me the parameters, what he's looking for, and he moves to Bakersfield from, and by this point, they're in North Carolina, and he moves my mom to Bakersfield, and her Alzheimer's was very, very progressive. It moved very fast, and a few months later, she passed. And my dad completely disconnected. He had been married to my mother over 40 years, and he couldn't handle it. And I got to step in sober, and I got to be there for my mom, and I got to help take care of her and make that amends to her through that, right? She had no idea. My dad would argue with her, and I'd be like, Dad, if she says the sky is green, the sky is green, you know, just meet her where she's at. And he just couldn't do it, and I was able to step in and be there. And when she passed, she was holding on and holding on, and it dawned on me. She's Catholic, and she was waiting for her last sacrament, and I was able to call the priest to come in and perform her last sacrament, and she passed away shortly after that. And what a gift. That never would have happened had I not worked the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so a couple months after my mom dies, my dad says, well, I don't like Bakersfield and I'm moving, but you can just have this house. And so, and there I am. And that's just stuff, right? I like to call those the side effects of sobriety, right? That has nothing to do with the experience that I have on a daily basis. And there's two things that I like to share towards the end of my share, as an example of working the program. So I talked to you guys a little bit about Mothers Against Drunk Driving in all of my court hearings. And when I did my inventory, I was very thorough. And for whatever reason, I did not put Mothers Against Drunk Driving on my inventory. And so a few years into my sobriety, I'm talking to my sponsor. And I say, somebody mentions Mothers Against Drunk Driving. I get this really ugly look on my face. She goes, did you leave them off of your inventory? And I said, my God, I did. I didn't do that intentionally. I just did. And she goes, well, I want you to call Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and I want you to ask them how you can be of service. And I thought, oh, you've got to be kidding me. And I call them, and they don't answer. And I'm like, thank God. Well, my side of the street's clean, right? Well, they called me back. And the lady that answered, she pretty much runs the program in Bakersfield, and she knew who I was, and she said, I've been following you. She goes, I want to know what changed. And, you know, I stuck to the script, my little index card. I said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm calling to see if I could be of service to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And I'm hoping to God that she says, no, but keep doing what you're doing. She says, oh, well, we have this impact panel. And she gives me the time and the date, and my sponsor goes, I want you to call me after that, after you go. So I go, and the room is packed, way more than that's in this room, right? And I said, God, this is a lot of people. Is this quarterly? And they said, no, it's monthly, and these are all repeat offenders. And it just blew me away, you know? I just stopped, and I thought, I wonder how many of us are sitting in here and don't even know it, right? And the craziest thing is that the head of the DUI task force, that district attorney, showed up that night. And he came up to me, and he gave me a hug, and he asked me the same thing. Well, what happened? What happened? I said, well, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here just to see if there's anything that I can do to be of service to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And I have a really good life today. I try to carry the message to other alcoholics. And he told me, you know, I never disliked you. I felt really sorry for you. And he said, you know, you just keep doing what you're doing. Keep helping other people. And I can just remember, I just got the chills. And I walked out of there, and I started sobbing. And I felt like the weight of 100 pounds had been lifted off of my shoulders. I could not believe the freedom that I experienced just from taking the suggestion and doing the work, right? And I got in the car, and I called my sponsor, and I couldn't even talk, and it was blubbering, and it was just such an amazing experience. And I no longer feel the way I felt for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Gratefully, they have not called me back to do any more service work, but I would go if they did, and willingly and happily. And the other thing I like to share is that My 2-year-old granddaughter was taken into protective custody. Her parents, my son, and the mom were having a hard time staying sober. And so they were taken by Child Protective Services. And I remember telling my sponsor, you know, they're never going to let me see Emma. You know, they're not going to let me pick her up anymore. And I was picking her up at this point every weekend to give her a little reprieve, right? Like, come over to my house, get spoiled by Nana. And we get do-overs in this program, right? And it was such an amazing opportunity to be able to do that. And I was devastated. And I'm like, man, they're never gonna let me pick her up. And Monica would say, my sponsor would say, are you God? And I'd be like, well, no, I'm not God, Monica, but hello. And she'd be like, wouldn't you want to tell Emma that you did everything you could for her? And that I could wrap my head around. I said, yes, I would like to be able to tell Emma that. So I set forth to ask for a criminal exemption. And the whole time I'm thinking, this is never gonna happen. And it was a really arduous experience. It took like 7 months. They had this therapist come out and interview me 2 days in a row for hours and left no stone unturned. And it was crazy. And when that therapist left my house on the last day, she said, I want to thank you for allowing me to have this experience with you. You're an amazing example of the human spirit and the capacity to change. And I started crying, and this therapist started crying. And I said, when will you make your decision? She said, I have to write a report. You'll hear something in about a week. And so I thought, I just felt such relief. It was as though it didn't matter what the decision was, right? I knew I had done everything that I could, and I'd be able to tell Emma that I did. And a week later, they call me, and I was granted that exemption. And by this time, my little granddaughter is with the maternal grandma, and she's doing well. And I'm just so grateful, right? Because now I get to pick her up. And I'm so happy about that. And a week later, my phone rings, and they're like, are you available for placement? And I'm like, what are you talking about? And so I call my, because you have all these different social workers. So I call my social worker, and she says, you weren't just cleared for your granddaughter. You were cleared for any child ages 1 through 18. And this kid that they wanted me to pick up was in juvenile hall, and this was to keep him out of a group home, which was close to my heart. And so we picked up this kid, and he was our first foster kiddo. And I can tell you that we've been doing this, at the time that I got cleared, I was engaged to be married to my husband in the program. And I said, you know, I don't know if you're willing to walk through this door with me, but God flew it open for a reason, and I know that I have to walk through it. There's no other explanation for why that happened. And he was willing to do it. And so we've been in doing that for about 3 years, and I can tell you it is the single hardest thing, other than having to experience death in sobriety, that I've walked through. I can't even begin to tell you the experiences I get to have with, is it my will or is it God's will? Am I just trying to save this kid because I want to show everybody that I can do it, or is it time to throw in the towel? And we get to walk through that and get to have that experience and get to be good examples of what life can look like, right, if we do the right thing. And how I get to have this amazing, incredible life that I have today, it's very, very simple, right? I work the 12 steps to the best of my ability, and now I get to do 10, 11, and 12, right? And 10 just asks me to do 4 things, right? It asks me to continue to look for the selfishness, the dishonesty, the resentment, the fear, right? And when these crop up, I ask God at once to remove them. And sometimes I don't like for God to remove them. I like to hold on to them for a while, right? And then I get to speak to somebody about that, right? And then what I get to do when I'm obsessing over it, because that's what I do. I don't know about you. Even 8 years in, I'm still obsessing on it. Like, and I'm going to say this, and they're going to say this. And then I get to turn my thoughts to someone I can help, right? That's what step 10 tells me. So that's like my catch, that catches me every day, right? And I do this throughout the day, right? And then step 11, right? In the morning, I have to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, because Jocelyn's best thinking gets her doing all kinds of crazy things. And what I can tell you, I can have an amazing day of service. Like today, this has been an amazing day. What an amazing group. I'm going to go home and I'm going to go to sleep and know that I did God's work, right? But what happens is somebody comes in and turns the switch off. And when I wake up in the morning, I'm not thinking of you. And I'm not thinking of how I'm going to be of service. I'm thinking of me. I'm thinking of what I have to do. I'm thinking it's cold. I don't want to get out of bed. I'm going to go to work. They're going to say that. I'm going to say this. And that's how I wake up, right? And so on awakening, I have to turn it over to God. I have to ask Him to clear away away what's blocking me from being useful to his kids, right? And I have to continue to do that throughout the day with the step 10. And then step 12, which is my favorite. Even on the worst of days, when I don't feel like it, if I have a commitment, I suit up and I show up, right? Because that is where God would have me be. And I can tell you, there are days when I don't want to. I have I have panels that I go on through H&I. I have a couple of women that I work with. And there's some days that I just don't want to do it. But what you've taught me is, it's not about how I feel. It's about what I do. It's about taking action. And I suit up and show up anyways. And God meets me there, man. That's where he meets me. This is where it's at, is intensive work with another alcoholic. When all other measures fail, that is what gets me through those certain trials and low spots. And I can tell you that that is where I feel closest to God, when I'm doing his work. And I'm actually done. I just want to thank you so much for having me. It's an amazing life. I want to encourage anybody here that has not worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to get a tour guide, get a sponsor. Let them walk you through those steps, because it's a pretty incredible life. And I just want to thank each and every one of you for showing me how to do this thing. Thank you.